This is Eitan Weinstein.
And I'm Naor Menninger, and you're listening to Two Nice Jewish Boys.
If Tel Aviv is the Silicon Valley of the Middle East, aka Silicon Wadi, cybersecurity is its beating heart. From the towering successes of Palo Alto Networks and Checkpoint to the relatively recent rise of Wiz, Israel stands as the undisputed leader in the realm of digital defense. At the core of this technological powerhouse lies Unit 8200, Israel's legendary intelligence unit known for honing the skills of some of the world's sharpest cyber minds. Graduates of 8200 venture after the army into the entrepreneurial landscape, seeding the growth of Israel's cybersecurity sector with their expertise and innovation. One of the things that truly sets Israel apart is the tidal wave of investment flooding into its cybersecurity ecosystem, propelling the nation to the forefront of global innovation. If you think about it, it's pretty crazy. Israel, or at least Israeli tech, is protecting a huge chunk of the world's most lucrative digital assets. Today, we're honored to host Alon Arvatz, one of the young new minds in the cyber realm. As an IDF cyber warfare veteran and tech product leader, Alon has authored the compelling book, The Battle for Your Computer, Israel and the Growth of the Global Cybersecurity Industry, where he unravels the intricacies of Israel's pivotal role in the global cybersecurity landscape. Alon, of course, also has a ton of experience in the cybersecurity industry. So we are thrilled to be joined today by Alon Arvatz on this episode of the Two Nice Jewish Boys podcast to discuss all things cybersecurity, AI, and even how it all connects to the current war in Gaza, apparently. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, I'm thrilled to be here as well.
So maybe we should start from there. How does, obviously there's a lot of cyber going on in Israel's war, but how does it connect specifically to the war going on right now in Gaza?
Well, there are so many touch points that you wouldn't believe. And one of the main things that it's also very important for me to tell to people is that a lot of bad things happened on October 7th. We all know the atrocities that happened. We all can tell like the numbers of how many were killed, how many were kidnapped, what time happened, what. What people are not aware of is what happened behind the scenes. What happened in the cyber space, what happened in the internet while Hamas was launching his attacks towards Israel. So while Hamas terrorists were running towards Israel kibbutzim and storming in, at the same time exactly, there was a cyber attack that took place. And while they were storming in, they started shooting missiles at Israel cities. And at the same time, a group of Hamas supporters actually launched an attack to take down the Red Alert mobile application. So for those at home that are not aware of the Red Alert mobile application, this is basically the mobile application that gives Israelis prior notification and alerts before missiles are hitting their neighborhood, giving them enough time to run for shelter. Now, what they tried to do while everything was in big mess and no one knew what's going on and missiles were shot towards Israel civilians, they took down the mobile app Red Alert
for— Did it succeed?
For a couple of minutes. It succeeded. But when missiles are shot at you, a couple of minutes is a lot of time.
Of course. And in the south, I think you have less than 15, 30 seconds.
In some places for sure. Yeah. And I think it's actually the first time in recorded history when someone actually launches cyber attacks to get people killed. So we know that cyber attacks are being carried out as part of warfare. So Russia, for example, do it all the time. They attack Ukraine, but usually they attack critical infrastructure like water, like electricity. That disturbs the day-to-day lives of people.
You could say it indirectly kills people. Not directly.
Probably not. Yeah. And this time, this was something that was really, was supposed to prevent people from protecting themselves and keeping them alive.
Wow.
So that's pretty insane. People are not aware of that. And that shows you that, Hamas has a lot of supporters around the world that was running that. And that they also, leverage cyber in their attacks. And I always talk about it. I also wrote about it in my book. So Israel, or in Israel in general, like their security and defense challenges always goes hand in hand with their opportunities, innovation. So we have to protect ourselves from infantry, but also from cyber attacks.
You need a cyber iron dome.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. We need a cyber iron dome, and that's what makes us a lot better in cybersecurity. And that's what, you know, later on makes us create amazing technologies and amazing companies. And same goes from another direction, from intelligence perspective. So in order to effectively protect ourselves, we have to have very, very good intelligence about our enemies, their plans, their capabilities, and based on that, better prepare ourselves. And that's what actually drove a lot of Israel efforts in developing cyber offensive capabilities. When it says cyber offensive, meaning capabilities to get into our enemies' computers, phones, and grab information from there, phone calls, texts, documents, and based on that, get like this high quality intelligence from behind enemy lines. And that forced Israel to create amazing cyber technologies, develop amazing cyber expertise. And that what built a lot of the talent that then went out and built also the companies in the private sector.
But I mean, it took a dark turn in some cases, right? So there's the infamous stories about NSO, and here in Israel, this is less internationally known, but Pegasus. So sometimes there's like the, there's obviously people putting it to no good, but most of the cases is Israeli innovators creating, right, you know, massive global enterprises that, you know, end up
right
making billions and billions of dollars.
Right.
Billions.
Exactly. But I have to say, I think that a lot of the problem with the discussion about the cyber offensive industry,
yeah,
and just to add more details into it, so when I say cyber offensive industry, I talk about private companies that develop hacking tools.
Mm-hmm.
So tools to or pieces of software that you can install on computers, on phones, and collect information from there. And these private companies, they sell these technologies to states,
mm-hmm,
to armies, yeah, to police.
It's like arms dealers in a way, in a sense.
Exactly. But you know, when you say arms dealer, it comes in a very negative connotation.
Yeah.
In reality, these technologies do a lot of good things. So it is very, very good when you use it to get information about pedophiles and stop them before they hurt kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, regular weapons do good things.
Exactly.
If they kill
exactly
bad people.
Exactly. But I think that this industry got bad reputation.
Bad reputation.
Yeah. Like, as an industry, we disqualify them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The reality is that, like, there are companies that goes to very bad directions, honestly, to be fair and honest, and goes to like dictators that want to oppress their people or follow journalists so they won't expose what they do worldwide, for example. But a lot of that is being used to sell to police to do good things,
yeah,
and to prevent terror,
yeah,
and prevent crime.
So would you say that even the most infamous cases are, they got a bad rap, sort of? Like NSO, for example, you
so
think mostly...
take NSO, for example.
Yeah.
And that's my perspective. I think it's pretty honest and unbiased perspective. Okay. NSO, they were disruptors. Before NSO, no one imagined that you can develop cyber offensive tool and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
It was something that was completely reserved for states and armies to build and use for themselves. No one imagined it. So when they started, there was no regulations. There were no discussions about what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. I would even say that in the early beginnings, it was hard to imagine what would people would use it for, mm-hmm, right? So to be fair, in the beginning, it was the Wild West,
yeah,
right? You know, you would sell to someone and it started doing bad things. So that was the first phase on the industry. Over time, people understood that some are doing with that bad things and some are doing with that good things. And then where companies started to do regulations, And also states started to do regulations on the companies within the sector. And some did it very effectively and some just didn't care. Mm. Like they were just there for the money and that's it. And that's where it became problematic. But I think that was like on the first phase, like there wasn't any discussion about what's appropriate and what's not. And that's something that was developed over the years. So it's like a natural development of an industry. And I think that we should judge company by company rather than the entire industry.
Mm. So, okay. So let's talk a bit about the cybersecurity startup space here in Israel. So you mentioned why you think it has sort of risen out of necessity, you know, from our military and from the fact that we need to create cyber defenses. Then we create these innovative minds. We sort of incubate them in the army, in the IDF, and then they go out and they create these crazy innovative technologies. What do you think is the biggest challenge for Israeli cybersecurity as it stands today? Like, what do you think is? Do you think that we have this like the undisputed rulers that we're gonna remain that way just because of, you know, the way that it's set up with, or do you think there's some big challenge that we're maybe not prepared for?
So definitely not. Okay. No one promised us that we'll remain the world rulers in cybersecurity. Definitely not. I would even say that there are significant risks to the cybersecurity industry. I think like the most concrete challenge is shortage of talent to build these companies. So mm-hmm. the main reason that Israel became such a powerhouse for cybersecurity companies is the talent you have here and the talent that is being built in the intelligence units and in the IDF. And in the end of the day, the talent here in Israel is very limited. We're a small country and we don't have much talent. And also it's impossible for us to import talent. So if you look, for example, at Silicon Valley, which I would say is the equivalent to Israel when it comes to cybersecurity, at least from like amount of companies perspective or companies per capita, right? Mm. They're the closest, Silicon Valley. So their solution is to import people. So they bring people from India, bring people from China, and they're like filling up all their engineers' open positions. Right, today in the Silicon Valley, I don't know if the most, but there are like significant portions of immigrants in the engineering organization.
Specifically Asian.
Specifically Asian.
Yeah.
Indian and Chinese. Yeah. These are the main ones. In Israel, it's not possible.
How
because
come?
Because we're a Jewish state and it would just never fly politically. Like no one is going to bring people here, at least not permanently. And if you don't bring people here permanently, they have a lot less incentive to come here to begin with. They would definitely rather go to the Silicon Valley, for example. So you cannot rely on this technique for Israel. It just won't work.
But is it relevant today with remote work? I mean, like, do you even need to move people?
Definitely, 100%. So first of all, today, almost all the companies in Israel work at least 3 days a week from the office.
Yeah.
And like creating this, you know, communication and knowledge transfer and building culture, it's still very important to be in the office. And the greatest indicator for that is that you can see that Palo Alto Networks keeps on buying companies in Israel.
Yeah.
Now, one reason is that you have amazing companies in Israel, which is true, but you have a lot of good companies all around the world. Why only Israel? And the reason is that they already have a big R&D site here already. And it's easier to plug in a company into an existing R&D site than buy a company in Singapore and build a new R&D site there.
I think it's not only the physical, like the physical proximity, but it's the cultural aspect that you mentioned.
That's true.
Meaning sometimes when you try and fit people from different cultures and different countries together, you merge companies, you know, one from India and one from Israel, one from India and one from the United States, there's a lot of cultural clash. And
exactly.
And the communication doesn't necessarily bring about good results.
Especially with Israelis.
Yeah.
We're not easy to digest, let's be honest.
Yeah.
I have to take a
bit of a step back to A200, because I don't know, we didn't really explain what is A200, why is it so important, what do people do there? Can you explain briefly?
So let me explain to you what is the experience of A200.
You served in A200, just to
right remember. but I didn't start in A200. I actually started in infantry. I started in a commando unit called EGOZ, and I was supposed to go to the intelligence corps, but I wanted to be a fighter, a combat warrior. So I decided to go for EGOZ, for the commando unit, and I hurt my hearing during training. I started like hearing beeps, and I had like hearing reduction, etc., hearing loss. I'm pretty okay, don't worry, but it prevented me from continuing to in this path. And after that, I moved to 8200. Now, it was amazing and a crazy experience, because you're staying in the same army, you move between units, so same uniform, you know, green uniform, same, I don't know, officers, etc. But from day one, I felt like I'm in a completely different planet. So
in what sense?
Yeah, so EGOZ, it was all about discipline and physical strength and aggressiveness. That's what it was all about. A200, it was all about thinking outside of the box and innovation and taking initiative and leading projects. And in A200, I could have sit on around one table with the commander of A200, who is the commander of 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 mine, and have a discussion about, hey, what is the best path for us to collect more intelligence or do intelligence assessment. In EGOZ, to talk to my direct commander, I had to schedule through someone, and I had to stand in front of him and salute until he allows me to start talk, and he was like half god.
Yeah.
So so it's a completely different culture. Completely different
more,
culture.
It sounds more like a corporation almost.
In a way, but a lot stricter, because it's army.
Yeah.
And discipline is a matter of like life or death.
But so what happens when you're sitting around a table with your commander? Like, do you have to speak to them in a certain way, or was it really a free for all? Anybody can say whatever they think.
Everyone can say whatever they think.
Wow.
That's
including hard. Hamas is going to attack us soon.
Yes. Yes. And to be fair, like, there were, prior to October 7th, there were cases where people
alerted.
Yeah, they alerted to their commander and he didn't pass it ahead. But if they would have been sitting around a table with whoever, they will be able to say it. And it was also published, by the way, which is really shame and I don't know.
Shocking.
And shocking, yes, and frustrating, that like this soldier that alerted, she asked to meet with the commander of 8200. Mm-hmm. And they had a meeting a week after October 7th on the calendar.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So she had the ability to knock on his door. She just didn't have enough time to do it.
So is that part of the, that's just insane. Know that. Is that part of the, is that like something well known within the unit or about the unit, that like, is that one of the principles of the unit, like in the idea of
accessibility?
Yeah, that you, that anybody can say whatever's on their mind, that yes, there are no,
that was,
there's
my
no distance.
Yeah, exactly. That was my experience. Okay. And it was very, very different from my prior experience. Now, to be fair, I would say that it's still an army. So I think that, like, in my startups, like for start the Alpha, I was, I think, more accessible than, I don't know, as a CEO, for example, than the commander of A200, because in the end of the day, it's an army, a lot of hierarchy, a lot of bureaucracy. So it's not 100% the same. But if you compare it to an army and a culture of an army, yes, it's extremely open, extremely accessible.
Wow.
And what makes the unit so special, like in technology perspective? And
So I'll tell you what. So first of all, the culture is special, like, to be fair. The culture is special. I love that. I also met with the commander of 8200 like a year ago. I interviewed him for the book. So he also attributed a lot of that, like, to the age.
Is it the new one?
It's the one
that the one now, that was now, yeah. That, now. That there were articles about him and
yes, mm-hmm. yes. And he's although he's an amazing person. Yeah, so there was a failure, but he's an amazing person. And
wait, this isn't Khalifa.
No.
This
no,
is
no,
someone
no.
under Khalifa.
Under Khalifa.
No.
What's yes. his name?
Yeah, it's a secret.
Yud. It's not unknown. It's unknown.
Yeah. Yud. Why?
Yud.
Yeah, so and he also attributed a lot to like the age of the people. So people recruit to the army when they're 18. So most of the people in 200 are between the ages of 18 and 23. So very vibrant, very energetic, you know, very out of the box thinking. And also, it's also very interesting because like the idea, we have a mandatory military service. So that mm-hmm. means that units like 8200 get to pick and choose the best of the best or the people that are the best fit for what they need to do. So they can choose like the brightest of the brightest, put them all together in one room and create like this, you know, radioactive, you know, explosion out of it. And I always, when I try to explain to people what is 8200 all about, so it's like, it's a place where you can get into like the dining room, right, of the army, which is just like you imagine, like in the movies, you have like, you know, you go with this tray in jail, right? And like this
slot. Yeah,
exactly.
There's worm is inside. Crawling.
Yeah, no, actually, the food was okay, but it's like, you know, like you can imagine, you know, like exactly yeah. like the Pruitt interior plate, and you sit around the table with your trays and your uniform, and you can have a discussion with your friends about the latest technology that was published or what startup you're going to found when you're going to finish with 8200.
Wow.
That can be like the discussion topic
that
over
is
lunch.
So far from the discussions we had over lunch. And I was in Nahal in infantry.
Oh, yeah.
So I mean, you can imagine you were in Egoz. So
the
discussions,
yeah.
I probably, the contrast there was also probably pretty shocking, no? Moving from Egoz to 8200.
Exactly. Now, that was extremely shocking. And you can also see that, you know, you put all these, you know, bright people together that are really, really good in tech and good things happen. So good things happen for 8200 for intelligence collection. Yeah. And also good thing happens when they finish their military service. And today, my two co-founders are people that I met at 8200.
Yeah, there was just an article that the co-founders of Wiz, there's Rappaport and
Acoustica,
they met on the bus to the Baku.
Oh yeah,
that's
recruitment to the IDF. But what's the mission statement of 8200?
So it's a very good question because the mission statement is to collect SIGINT, which is basically collect signals that are being transmitted by our enemies and collect intelligence. Signals can be phone calls, can be text messages, can be digital information on computers,
media.
On social media, in emails. All of this information they need to collect. They need to assess it and share it with the decision makers.
Okay. So there's the part of the unit, I'm assuming, there is the part of the unit that's like listening in and translating. And then there's a part of the unit, I'm assuming, that is in charge of creating those pieces.
Develop technological capabilities, technological capabilities.
And
allow us to intercept the signals.
Hackers,
analysis, yes.
Basically.
Not only.
No,
because we also need to intercept like phone calls. So there are a lot of techniques that you need to do. It's not only computers
and
smartphones. Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of hackers. Yeah, a lot of hackers.
Oh, that's
as well.
Interesting. So is there anything that you could tell us that you can tell us, first of all, that's not like what you would imagine? So it's not coding, it's not hacking, like phone calls, for example.
Yeah, like phone calls. Also something that's very interesting, that a lot of people are responsible for building the solutions to digest the information.
Okay.
So imagine that you collect huge amounts of data, huge amounts of data, and you need to store them effectively, index them effectively, like saving them in a way that it will be easy to pull. And you also want to analyze them to surface things that are urgent, for example.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of people that are actually not are not dealing with collecting the data, but actually
managing
the data and making it accessible, right? Mm-hmm.
It's a whole operation.
It's a huge operation. It's a huge corporate, by the way. I think 8200 is the biggest unit in the IDF.
I'm not sure it's allowed to say how many.
Yeah, you're not. Right? So I think it's a pretty big unit.
Wow. Okay. So you mentioned you met your two co-founders in the unit. Did you meet them like on day one? Did you meet them?
No. Actually, it's interesting. Like, they're younger than me.
Okay.
And I met them in my last year of service, right? When they started, more or less. And we did like a few operations together. There was a click. We worked very well together. It was really funny, like on the event when I was like, you know, saying goodbye to everyone. So Gal, my co-founder, he came, and after you finish talking and eating, so people come, congratulate you, stay in touch, etc. When Gal reached out to me to say bye, I told him, Gal, one day we'll do something together. Mark my words. Nice. And he was laughing at me. He had like 4 years of service ahead of him, by the way. So he was pretty visionary at that point. Guess what? 4 years later, we founded Insights.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
4 years, so meaning right after he left.
Right after he finishes service, we start Insights.
Wow.
Like our first, like, by the way, our first meetings about Insights and what we want to do was him on uniform sitting with us and brainstorming.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how does it work, this transition? Because there's tension, right? I mean, A200 has an interest for people to stay. And also there's some knowledge that you don't want to be used outside. So how do you manage that?
It's a great question that I was really intrigued with when I started the research around my book. So I made sure I'm interviewing a few ex-8200 commanders and ask them exactly that. Are you happy with what's happening, that there is such a thriving cybersecurity ecosystem? It makes people want to leave 8200 and not stay for the long run. And you have to work very hard to retain talent. So you have, and like you said, by the way, there's also the aspect of using your technologies as well.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly enough, they all answered the same thing. I asked three of them, by the way. They all said the same thing. No, we're not concerned about it whatsoever. For us, it actually makes us stronger, because one, these people build the Israeli economy with their cybersecurity companies, and that's how we collect taxes, and that's what's fund 8200. So my budget comes from these people eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And two, and that was also very interesting, 8200 success is due to the talent it can attract. So yeah, they can choose anyone, but they won't recruit someone who doesn't want to be in 8200, even if he's really, really talented. So the fact that people really want to get into 8200 because they know that after they finish, they will have a lot of opportunities outside, it helped them attract the best talent.
Mm-hmm.
And also allow them to get people that are a lot more prepared, because people also preparing for their military service to get it to 8200 to begin with. So they get a lot better talent. So they say, okay, it allows me to get like amazing talent. Now it's my job to retain the people that I need for the long run. So for me, it's a win-win. Now, the only place where they said I'm concerned is about people leaving 8200 and using 8200 capabilities in the cyber offensive industry. This is the only place where they said, okay, that's disturbing. And because basically, you know, and maybe it's important to understand why, because when you have a certain hacking capability, you want to make sure it's very, very exclusive, and it's being used only in very specific cases, because the more you use it, the riskier it is of it being exposed, right? Because there are a lot of cybersecurity companies.
And they're becoming ineffective.
Because once they're exposed, all the security companies know how to block them, and that's it. You need to find new capability.
Yeah.
And hacking capability is something very, very hard to find. So you want to keep them very exclusive. So you want to make sure that other people are not using it indiscriminately. And that's the only place where there is like regulation, like in Israel, like to make sure that people are not are using these technologies. And actually, like, you know, Israeli like exports regulation is making sure partly this part as well. Right. But I'm sure the things there are, by the way, I'm sure it's not bulletproof, I have to say, to be honest.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit. So you 4 years later, you founded Insights. Tell us a little bit about Insights and about how that came to be.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting story. So actually, after I finished my service on that day that I talked to Gal, I went for a year in a yeshiva, and then I started university. I went to study law and accounting. Don't ask me why. My dad told me, why are you doing it to yourself? My dad also studied accounting. So he was like, why are you doing it to yourself? You should study engineering. But I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I felt like this might help me. And actually through my time in university, I realized that I want to be an entrepreneur. Like, I don't really want to sit and study all day. I founded a nonprofit for financial literacy for teenagers. That was my first venture. And then the next one was Cyber School. That was a company for cybersecurity training and education for teenagers. So we did workshops, courses. We did even one summer camp. It was pretty cool. And then we sold that one. And basically my co-founder from Cyber School, Guy, he came to me and said, Alon, I have an idea for our next startup. And I told him, I'm in. What's the idea? Yeah. That's more or less how it goes. But really, like, he told me he has an idea of actually automating the process of collecting information from the internet, from cybercrime forums, from places where people published stolen information, stolen documents, stolen credentials, and make sure that we help enterprises know about that very quickly and take action. So
basically to like monitor the stolen goods and then alert companies that, hey, your stuff's been stolen.
Stolen goods, like credentials, like documents, like sensitive information, to alert about hackers planning to attack your company or finding vulnerabilities in your website, for example.
I see.
Like identifying attacks as they emerge, like someone now opened a website and is going to use it to send phishing emails to your employees. So all this type of indication that you can find outside, we wanted to provide visibility to our customers to that. So all security solutions actually monitor your computers and your network and help you identify risks and attacks. We're the only one that's actually looking outside your network.
You guys are going undercover.
Exactly. We're intelligence unit, by the way.
Okay.
It's the 80-200 of enterprise, only that we cannot get into phones and computers because it's illegal.
Yeah.
So we collected from forums, from social media, from various websites on the internet.
I see. You roam around the darky and seedy parts of the internet.
Exactly.
To find out what the criminals are up to.
Exactly. And by the way, we had a team that their job was to get into these forums and places, get access so we can collect the data, because a lot of a lot of the access was vetted.
That's tricky.
Exactly. So you had to, by the way, so most of the dark web, for example, is in English. Language number two is Russian. That's pretty common as well. So for example, for Russian forums, you have to, you know, look and sound Russian.
Look like
the way you write and the way your profile picture looks like and the way your name is look like, then it has to be in Russian. And it also got to a point, there was one forum where, like, if you wanted to get on the forum, you had to go through a quiz. And it was a quiz about Russian history and culture. like things,
but
like,
can't you people just look up the answers on the internet?
No, because it's like I don't know, cult sentence, like quotes from cult movies from the 80s. Like, my people called their parents to find out the answers.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Even 8200 wouldn't be able to penetrate that.
Yeah.
That's pretty insane.
So the company is you're still the CEO of the company?
No. So Insights, we scale it up to like over $30 million in ARR. And then we sold it to Rapid7. And then we sold it to Rapid7, which is an American cybersecurity company, a pretty big one, for $350 million. And at my through my time at Rapid7, I wrote the book, The Battle for Your Computer, about the Israeli cybersecurity industry. And when I had enough of Rapid7, I decided to found the next startup. Actually, this time not in cybersecurity. It's in cloud cost optimization. It's called Point5. And today I'm the CEO of Point5. We're pretty early in the game, but getting momentum.
Amazing.
And are these also these are also friends from 8200?
It's one of my founders from it's Gal.
From the Insights. One
from Insights, the one I told him that one day we'll do something together. And then and the second one was our VP engineering at Insights. And we also worked with him at 8200. And now it's the three of us.
Insights was sold when?
2021.
Yes. So that was like at the height of Israeli tech, yeah. I feel like.
You can say the bubble. It was a bubble. It was it's okay.
So how does, like, there's a couple questions there, but how did it feel to
get the money?
How did it feel to exit? Because on one hand, obviously, it's like, wow, we sold for $350 million. But on the other hand, there was a lot of, I feel like, sentiment in the last 5 to 10 years in Israeli tech that, hey, we can do this. Like, it used to be the dream of every Israeli entrepreneur to exit and to sell for, you know, whatever. But then in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, it was like, hey, we can do this on our own, like Palo Alto Networks, like Checkpoint. Right. We can become these conglomerates and we don't need to sell. So like, was there any tension there? Was there any like, hey, we want to take this all the way? Or
yes, in a way. So I was personally and my co-founder as well, like we were always, you know, let's take it for the long run. The fact that we got to a scale of $30 million was pretty unique. People who knows the industry, people usually when they sell their companies, it's at $1, $2, $3 million, something like that. Okay. So we did reach a scale and our vision was to build something that is big. Even before it was cool to build big companies, by the way, like we found it in 2015. Only in 2020, people started talking about unicorns and big companies, etc. But that was our dream. But I can say that not all companies have justification to be big companies and operate for the long run. Not always there is justification, not always the market is big enough, not always like the market dynamics make sense. And when we get to a point where we felt like, okay, the right thing for a company like ours is to become big, part of a bigger suite. And we also saw, you know, obviously the challenges of, you know, growing consistently over many years. That was the point where they decided to sell the company.
Yeah.
So yeah, so it was hard. And actually like the selling, like honestly, I know it would sound like, you know, weird in a way, but it didn't feel like, you know, an amazing thrill or I reached a new height. It felt like pretty much the opposite. Like I was for 6 years at Insights and I had like very, very high energy and tension every day. Of doing more and developing more and et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly, in one day, once I signed it, it pretty much disappeared.
Wow.
Right?
You weren't, Rapid didn't take you on? I mean, they did take you on. You were like
it's
a
not,
director of,
it's not the
right?
same energy. You know,
it's
not the same energy.
It's corporate.
It's different pace. It's a different
How long did you sign on for there?
2.5 years. I left after 1.5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. That's also, I feel like, something that's I don't know if it's like unspoken or, but there's often these acquisitions and they bring on the founders, and I wonder what your perspective is on that. Like, does it, because it feels like it's almost like caging a lion, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like it's like,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like the right strategy. I get the thinking that like, okay, we need the guy who founded this to, but I'm wondering what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I have a very different perspective on that.
Okay.
So first of all, like to be honest, there are entrepreneurs that join like these corporates and they thrive inside. Mm-hmm. It happens, right? Like corporates that manage it very, very successfully, it can work out. Like the CEO of Rapid7 was entrepreneurs. They bought his company like 7 years before, for example. Mm. An example from Israel. So Asaf Rapoport, his company was acquired by Microsoft, and he became the manager and leader of their Israeli site, and he was there beyond his commitment.
Yeah.
Right? Because he felt like he's thriving
mm-hmm.
and learning, etc. Most of the entrepreneurs, that's not the case. That wasn't my case as well. Most of them, it's like, you know, there is a famous saying, rest and vest, right? Meaning, yeah, you need to stay the commitments to collect the money.
Yeah.
But you're here like to pass your time, honestly. Yeah. And I think that very often that's the case. And this is why my personal perspective is that making people to stay because of the money is not a good strategy. That's not how you build a good culture. That's not how you get people that follow these leaders, right? This is not how you motivate them. You need their leaders to be more motivated than them. You need to be their leader to feel like it's the most exciting thing they do.
Yeah.
And when you take entrepreneurs that 1 minute ago the company was theirs and they could make any decision they want and drive it where they want, and suddenly make them part of a big corporate, they would almost always lose this passion and energy. My personal perspective is that the industry needs to move to a model where you take the entrepreneurs, you give them, you don't have like 2, 3, 4 years. You have 1 year, and your job is to find and grow the right leaders to replace you. This is your job. You have a limited time, and that's what you do. You create the leadership that can maintain the culture, maintain the energy, maintain the innovation, and will replace you. If you can find people from inside, amazing, because suddenly everyone can grow, everyone can go to the next level.
Yeah.
So that's my personal perspective, and I hope that the industry would go this direction. There are people that did it, like Mickey Boudaï. He was the CEO of Trusteer. Transmit is his current company, and this is what they brought him for like 6 months. That was his job, to do the transition, and he moved on, and everyone were happy.
I think that's Apple's approach, if I'm not mistaken. I read recently that they don't bring on, I mean, I don't know if they do the 6 months to a year, but they don't bring on founders.
Oh yeah.
Apparently they buy them out and they say goodbye.
Go home.
In the few minutes we have left, I want to get back to the book. So okay. If you can share with us a few stories maybe from the book. I don't know exactly, like something I want the juice.
The juice.
About the unit, about the cyber industry. Like give us something.
Something juicy.
Yeah. For example, what else did the 8200 command? Do you touch the whole NSO controversy in the book?
Yeah, for sure. I touched that as well. And I also shared, you know, some of my perspective around that. And I said, Israeli companies do things that are, problematic in many ways. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll touch a different point. Actually.
Okay.
I'll touch the point that ends my book.
Okay.
Which is also extremely relevant to nowadays. So my book ends. So the last, like, you know, part of my book is dedicated to the risks or the future of the Israeli cybersecurity industry. And part of that is the risks to the industry. And I finish with what I feel is like a huge risk. And that is like Israeli arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that because we're getting so young to do crazy cyber offensive operation in the IDF, and then we found companies right after in such a young age, so people are getting here very arrogant, okay, too quickly. And one that's, I think that's our, maybe our biggest risk to maintaining this leadership. But also it's kind of part of the culture and characteristics of Israeli companies. And one interesting, funny story is a story that Gili Ranan told me. He's like probably leading cybersecurity investor here in Israel. He was also an entrepreneur himself. And his company, one of his first prospects was X.com. You know what X.com?
Yeah, of course.
So X.com, not today, back then. I'm talking to you in 1999.
Yeah.
So it wasn't Twitter. It was Elon Musk company.
Yeah.
It was a digital 99? Bank.
99? That's like, is that pre...
Tesla
PayPal? And,
So they merged with PayPal. Elon Musk, X.com, merged with PayPal. And they took the PayPal name, but it was a merge of two companies.
Okay.
And like, they did a POC. So he did a POC, Gili Ra'anan, as an entrepreneur, with X.com. So X.com tested his cybersecurity solution. And they were able to find a crazy vulnerability that essentially would allow people to move money between accounts at X.com, something like insane. And wow. And they had a joined investor from Sequoia, and Gili talked to X.com. They agreed on a price. I think it was $300,000, which is also insane for today.
Yeah.
And then he forwarded it to his investor in Sequoia, and and this investor wrote to Elon Musk, I think you have a security issue, because he shared with him like the findings. And then Elon Musk forwarded Gil email and wrote him, "You're, I don't know, like you're an idiot. I'm never doing business with you." And that's it, something like that. So that's how, like,
so I'm just trying to Gili forwarded the $300,000 offer
with the findings
yes. with the security vulnerability in it to his investor.
Yeah.
And then the investor.
And he said, I think you have an issue you need to resolve quickly, because he was a board member. And he said, okay, you have to solve it quickly, because it's like, it's really critical stuff. Wow. It was a little funny. When he sent the email to Elon Musk, he wrote, "Excuse Gili's paratrooper language and approach." Wow. Yeah. And so that's how they left the guild. So sometimes,
and you tie that to arrogance.
I think, like, you know, it's like, you know,
hubris.
In a way, and like, you know, getting like too excited too quickly and doing it in a very early age. Yeah. Okay. More to that, and I think the result of that is also arrogance. Like that the more accurate way to frame it.
Yeah.
Okay. Actually, Gili is not an arrogant person, honestly.
So what stops like Iran from building the best language model ever and use it to find vulnerabilities in the Israeli alleged nuclear facility? You know, just
they do that all the time. They do it all the time, and we have to protect. So we need to find these vulnerabilities before they do and close them.
Mm-hmm.
We have to monitor our systems to identify when things like that happen and block them. And this is what Israel does all the time.
So the whole industry will shift, or maybe already shifted, to AI versus AI, because the one who has the best AI to find the vulnerabilities will win, or still the human has an advantage in those areas?
So, first of all, AI is built by humans. It's important to understand. So like,
until it doesn't.
Yeah. So it's still very much driven by human talent. Yes. Mm-hmm. We're definitely not in the era of AI versus AI. I would even say that we're pretty far from there. Like, it's not something that we'll see in the next few years. But yeah, it's mostly driven by big people that develop these capabilities and tools and find these vulnerabilities. And it's like, it's a cat and mouse game, I guess.
So should we sleep good at night?
No.
5200 post
you want to sleep
7?
Good, take a Valium.
And move to Australia.
Yeah, but that's just because of the heartburn and the peeing in the middle of the night. It has nothing to do with Iran. Anyway, thank you so much, Alon. It was really fascinating.
Yeah. Let's plug the book again.
Yeah, so can you tell us?
So the book is called The Battle for Your Computer. You can find it on Amazon.com.
There's a digital copy as well.
There's a digital copy. There is an audiobook as well.
Okay.
And
bookstores in America? Is it in bookstores?
Yeah, but not consistently. So okay. If you want to make sure you get it, go to Amazon.
Okay.
And yeah,
who goes to a bookstore anymore?
He tells a lot of interesting stories, like Gillies, and talks about all different aspects of like the controversies around the cyber offensive industry, and analyze the cause of the success, and also talk about the risks to the Israeli industry.
Is there a Hebrew version, or did you just write it in English?
Actually, I wrote it in Hebrew, and then translated it to English.
Oh, yeah. So there is a Hebrew version.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Nice.
Yeah. Cool. Actually, the translator of the book has become the spokesperson of a prime minister officer in Israel. Right after I finish translating my book.
Ilan Levy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. He just got fired, by the way. But
yeah.
So I always say that like he got to this amazing job thanks to translating my book.
Nice. Okay. Great. Are you on Twitter?
No, I'm on LinkedIn.
Security breach.
You're on LinkedIn.
Yeah, for now.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. Having me. Good luck in your future startups.
Thank you very much.
Bye, guys.
Bye.